This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. The wisdom of Marshall Eddie Conway, political prisoner recently released after more than 43 years behind bars on a government frame-up, who exemplifies the power of love, whether behind the walls or now back in the community, and who instructs on the educational key to self-growth and realization within the collective process of striving for human rights and fundamental change. And we are going to present to you Marshall Eddie Conway, just back amongst us, although the bars didn't really prevent him from being with us. In his corporeal sense, yes, but not intellectually. We're going to listen to Marshall Eddie Conway now.
Thank you. Political prisoners represent a certain class of prisoners in the prison system. And all the other prisoners watch and look at what they do, how they behave, and who's supporting them. And the fact that they're not isolated allows other brothers and other sisters to look and study and try to become activists, because they can see that there's an example, and they can see that there's support for that example, and they can see that there's a possibility of building a future community that's different from what we have been subjected to. Right. One of the things that I was confronted with in 1970, I got locked up. There was a confrontation in Baltimore. Police got killed. Panthers got locked up. I end up in the prison system. When I end up in the prison system, George Jackson and the Black Guerrilla family and those organizations was operating on the West Coast. Attica was operating on the East Coast, and people were organizing, and there was riots, and there was all kinds of things. I was confronted with the fact that, okay, I'm in jail, and I'm a revolutionary, and I'm an organizer, and there's 2,000 prisoners here. What do I do? And I looked at both situations, East and West, and I looked at both methodologies of how people were organizing and how people were developing struggle in their particular area. And I worked with a small cadre of brothers, and I spent like months educating and giving them political education and organizing them into something that we end up calling the Maryland Penitentiary Intercommunal Collective. And we decided to use the tools that we had available to organize and mobilize the population. And the first thing we did was we organized the United Prisoners Labor Union. And I'm glad to report that 1199E, under Fred Punch in Baltimore, came forward and supported us. Congressman Perrin Mitchell came forward and supported us. People in the community came forward and supported us. And we organized 500 prisoners that said they wanted minimum wage, health care, to be treated like human beings. And it was that organizing that caused the administration to unleash the wrath on our organization. Ultimately, they tried to kill me. They tried to kill other people. They created opposition to us in the yard with like young gangs that were mercenary. It led to gang warfare in the system, but we continued to organize. We organized the library. It was none. We organized forums that brought civic communications and information people in the prison. We reached out into community, and we organized survival programs outside for the families of prisoners to come and interact with and get support around the conditions that they were facing when they were trying to come in and out the prison system. and throughout the years, we stumbled across the American Friends Service Committee, and we asked them to help us organize young brothers to be mentors for younger brothers. And the process led to us not only organizing in five prisons and in a federal prison and out in Seattle, Washington right now. Of course, there was backlash. Some of our programs were shut down because they claimed we were too radical or we were teaching black nationalism, which wasn't the case. We were teaching humanism. We were teaching that brothers needed to stand up for their community, that they had a responsibility to restore and build. We were teaching that, and that was something that the Guard forces and other people did not want to happen. And so they tried to shut the programs down. But one of the things that they had to come to realize is that where we organize, and the last program that we organized is called Friend of a Friend. Back during slavery, the abolitionist movement created the Underground Railroad, and the Underground Railroad used that term to identify slaves that were fleeing from the plantation and heading north to Canada. And the slave would come up to the Underground Railroad location and knock on the door, and somebody would say, "Who is it?" And they would say, "A friend of a friend." And that would help them move on to freedom. And so that's what we thought. We need to figure out, because we're dealing with plantations, we're dealing with slavery, it's just another name. We needed to figure out how to help brothers. And so that's what we did. We said, well, okay, we will mentor these brothers. We will get them engaged. We will get them involved. And we will take advantage of opportunities, use it to organize them. And so we organized things like in the prison system, the Katrina relief support effort from prisoners, and raised money and got food and got donations and send that stuff down to Katrina and showed the people down in New Orleans that, one, we cared about them, but showed the brothers in the penitentiary that they had a sense of responsibility beyond just their particular organizations, beyond the things that was going on in the prison system. Everybody in America was part of their community, and they had to start operating and acting like that. And it's now to the point where the prison that I went in 2009 is called Jessup Correctional Institute. When I got there, every week somebody was stabbed. Most of the time, somebody died. Because of shock trauma and the new medicine and all the rest of that stuff, they didn't always die, but they end up injured, they end up in bad shape, and so on. Once a week in 2009, I was stepping over bodies coming back from lunch. Right away we decided that we needed to do something about that. So I went to the Bloods, and I went to the Crips. I went to the BGF. I went to the Muslims, to the Christians, to the Nation of Islam, to the Moes, and I talked to them and got and recruited from each one of those organizations two positive people and brought them together in a room and talked to them about saving our community and saving our youth. They sat there, they thought about it, they got educated, they formed their particular curriculum. They determined how they was going to interact with the young people, and they started working together. And of course, that was the purpose, to get them to work together. But something else happened. By them working together, the Murder Inc., that's like the Muslims, that claim they don't have a gang, but they do, right? And they kill. Murder Inc., BCF, Bloods, Crips, whatnot, they started learning and started communicating with each other. And pretty soon, when there was a problem in the prison, they talked to each other. Joe don't like what Bill did. Something got to go down. Hold up. Let me talk to Joe. Let me talk to Bill. And the reason why I'm taking this time to tell you this is because we are in trouble. We're in trouble for real. They started dealing with those problems by talking to each other. They started resolving those conflicts. When I left, in 2014, less than 6 months ago, no stabbings in the prison of 2,000 people at all. And so far, it's been 18 months, and I'm hoping that it continues. And what we decided was we needed to do that out in our neighborhood. So when I came home, but I'm gonna tell you, I got out on March the 4th. March the 5th, I'm riding through Baltimore, and I'm seeing people bent over. I'm seeing people laying up against the wall, young people just out there. I said to myself, like, well, okay, 44 years, I need a break. I need to rest. I want some sex. I want to chill out, right? But look, I realized Baltimore looked like a war zone. And the conditions scared me so much that I got up the next day and called somebody and said, come help me do this work. I said, well, wait a minute, brother, wait a minute. No, we got to do this work now. And like 4 days later, we were organizing for the Malcolm X grassroots movement. I just want you to know, on May 19th, we established a coalition of friends. So in the jail, there's friends of a friend. Outside the jail now, there's a coalition of friends. And we use that same model, Christians, ex-gang members, Muslims, black nationalists, revolutionaries, Quakers, college students, and just activists, and young people, poets, and pull them all together and say, look, we got a problem. We need to address it. The epicenter of violence in West Baltimore, and there's an epicenter of violence in all the areas, but in West Baltimore, it's the Gilmore Homes. It's Sandtown. Body strapping right and left. And so we said, we're not going up in there to teach them anything. We're going up in there to share with them, to work with them, to be there for young people, to be there for people that want to get political education, to be there for people that need to figure out how to use their resources. We went up in there. Right now, we've been feeding lunches, the old survival program, healthy lunch, and we can only afford to do it once a week. We organized a community cookout. We're working on the repair stuff in the community. We're getting ready right Tuesday. When I get back to Baltimore, in fact, we'll be giving out book bags, school supplies, up in the projects. And we're going to stay in those projects, and we're going to work with those brothers. And it's a good thing is that the street organizations, what we call gangs, from work inside the prison, recognize the need to do something about their community outside, and they have sent word from inside the prison to outside to say, let them brothers and sisters work. And so they let us up in their community. And even when we're up in their community and we're doing cookouts and whatnot, there's dudes standing around that's strapped. I know they're strapped because you can see that they're strapped. But they're making sure nothing happens in the community. That's what we got to start doing. We got to figure out how to stop all this petty bickering. That's the one thing that shocked me was there's an organization here, there's an organization there, there's an organization there, there's an organization over there. And yeah, we done had some rough time. And COINTELPRO, and that's my book right there, The Greatest Threat, I did that book for my master's thesis. And it's a study of COINTELPRO and how it destroyed the Black Panther Party. And it's a study of why Black Panther Party prisoners are political prisoners. And every one of them are in there. That's the research right there, that anybody that wants to validate whether or not they're political prisoners, it's in that book. That's what I did. The bottom line is that COINTELPRO screwed us all up. We don't trust our neighbor. We don't trust agitators. We don't trust people that we're suspicious of. We don't trust people that we had personal beefs with at some point. They divided us in such a way, and the ramifications is 40 years later, we're still suffering the consequences, and we're still having the inability to interact. This is my group, that's your group, this is their group, and so on. We need to stop it. All of them brothers that's in jail, and a lot of them died while I was in jail. I could have died myself. You know, I mean, there was like three attempt assassinations on me, and one of them was really almost successful, but I'm here. But those brothers that I seen die, not just the brothers in jail, but Zay was one of my best buddies. He died on the street, but I taught him how to drive. I don't know if anybody ever trusted him with a car or not. Right? But a lot of people died over the years to bring a better world, better conditions. This is not the only reality. This is not the only choice. Those brothers need our collective support now. And it's like what Malcolm X said decades and decades ago. Stop all this little petty squabbling. Stop all your beef. Stop all of your conflicts. You got a common problem. You got a common enemy. You got a common struggle. You need to work together. That's why I work with the Bloods. I'm not a Blood. That's why I work with BGF. I'm not that. That's why I work with Muslims. I'm not. That's why I work with Christians. I'm not. I'm a revolutionary. I'm an internationalist. But I don't know exactly. It doesn't even make a difference what the hell you are. You need to be working around something that can change the conditions in your community. And it doesn't make any difference what flag you're flying, what ideology you're promoting. You need to be doing the work. The fact of the matter is, if you understand trends, you will understand that those twin evils, capitalism and white supremacy, they're both in trouble. And the first one is in trouble because of automation and cyber nation. You cannot get around the fact that the machines are here to stay and they're not going to go anywhere, that the factories don't need us. That's why you have that growth in the prison system. That's why you have almost 2.5 million people in the prison system, which 74% of them are people of color, incidentally. But you have those people in the prison system because they're no longer needed in the workforce. Because the factories that worked in my neighborhood to make cars, Fisher Body, had 5,000 people in it when I got locked up. Now it's automated and cybernated. And you see pictures, the cars come through the assembly line, the robot arms bring the doors down, another arm bring the window in, another arm put the engine in there. There's a technocrat over on the side pressing buttons. That's one factory that had 5,000 people, now operates with 500 people, 10% of the workforce. 90% of the workforce is gone. That's one factory. The same thing is happening in the factories that do your food. The same thing is happening in the factories that make your clothing. The same thing is happening in the factories that produce your iPhones. The same thing is happening all over the industrial world. Capitalism is automating and cybernating and is doing away with the workforce. But there's a problem. Who's going to buy the products? Who's buying the iPhone? Who's buying the clothes? Who's buying the car? You know, so at some point, you can buy off the workers by food stamps. You can buy off the workers by unemployment. You can buy off the workers by doling out government taxes. But at some point, the ability to do that diminishes. the ability to take care of everybody that's been replaced by the machines is getting to a point where it's no longer obtainable. So bam, the prison system develops. That's also taking your tax money. But at some point, even that becomes unmanageable. So the trend is that because of mercenary capitalists, greedy avaricious, dare I say pigs, they are pricing themselves out of the market. Capitalism itself is declining because of its success in wedding with science and technology. The trend is there. The change is occurring. We just have to be aware of it, and then we have to organize down on the ground, because who's going to take care of us? How are we going to manage ourselves? Who's going to feed us? What happens when that 26 weeks of food stamps run out, or whatever the deal is now? What happens then? Who feeds us? Who takes care of us? This is why we have to start organizing. We have to start figuring out how to take care of ourselves, but beyond Walmart, beyond Target, beyond the things that they put in our community that can be stopped overnight. You know, you look at places like Ferguson, and there's a no-fly zone. You look at Ferguson and you realize that there's a beltway around Ferguson, and there'll be a no supply zone in a minute, and there's no food. So how do you compensate for that? So you have to start, and this is like one of the things that we're doing right now with the group that we're working with. We're creating a urban garden that's going to raise food in the community. We're doing that, and we're doing that deliberately because we're looking into the future. And we're going to name that garden. People know how I feel. We're going to name it after Sunday Out There Colon. You know, it's going to be a garden in his name. And why? Because not only do we need to organize, but we need to educate with our organizing. Not only do we need to organize, but we need to organize in a way that, one, will sustain us in developing the community, but two, that will make people ask questions. Well, who is this dude? Why y'all got a garden named after him? And then we can educate, and then we can build, and then we can tell. And that's one of the things that we need to do for every one of the political prisoners in here. In that book, we need to establish programs for them. You know, and I'll just give you an example. In Baltimore, just recently, there was something I participated in called the Eddie Conway Liberation Institute. It happened at Morgan University. They brought in 20 students from around the country. They did this last year. They named it after me. They did it this year. This year, I was there with the students, right? And I got to not only talk to them and encourage them, because they're all like high school students, right? Not only encourage them and talk to them, but I got them to come down in Ground Zero and work in the community and play with the children and interact, so that they would understand that they not only have to learn the skills of debating about issues in our community, but they have to also learn the necessity to participate in making changes around those issues that they're debating about. And it is stuff like that that's important. It's stuff like that that helped me sustain myself. And it is stuff like that that we'll have to do for the other brothers and the other sisters before we lose anybody else. We need to do that, and we need to focus. But I'm encouraging us to focus. And I'm thinking that we need to concentrate on one or two cases. And I'm not saying we don't look at everybody else, but if we gather our resources and we target who we think can be released, Veronica Ballas.
Right, right.
He got recommended for parole, what, 4, maybe 10 years ago? He got recommended for parole, and they took it from him just before he got to the door. That was politics. He can go. He is the one of all the political prisoners that Holder and Obama, not going to say anything here, can straighten that out if they wanted to. So that there, that's one thing that can happen. Pressure can be put there somewhere to get him that parole that's already been recommended. And that's not to say that to ignore other things. The thing of it is this. If you use these cases to start breaking that hold, you get stronger in the next case, because you can say, look at this, and look at this. And you can use that to say, you need to look at this. Because all those people were held for these 3-4 decades because of the politics. Now they're out. Why are you holding him? Or why are you holding her? So, but what I'm saying is, focus for a minute. Get a victory. I mean, over the years, that's where my head comes from, right?
The wisdom of the irrepressible, brilliant Marshall Eddie Conway.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.